For those of you not familiar with IGD, we're an alliance of more than 400 business leaders who are working to reduce global poverty on two tracks. One, on the policy front, we're promoting a more comprehensive global development strategy to create an environment in poor countries where business can thrive. And on the enterprise front, we're actively working in partnership with business leaders from frontier markets to increase enterprise growth and investment through a program called Frontier 100. IGD is well represented here today. Tim Salso, one of the panelists, is a member of our board, as is Rob Mosbacher sitting down here in the front. Rob's new paper, A New Strategy to Leverage Business for International Development, has just been published by Brookings, and I think it's available in the back of the room for participants. Also available at the back is a publication IGD just came out with called The Business Case for Aid Reform, and I think they make a nice companion pieces to each other. Tim, Rob, and Justin Chinyanta are all members of the Frontier 100. We are so pleased to partner with Brookings and Kamal Dervis on this event. Kamal is the Vice President and Director of Global Economy and Development at Brookings, as well as a member of IGD's Leadership Council. Kamal, in just a moment, will introduce our panel, but it is now my pleasure first to introduce to you Daniel Yohannes. Daniel was sworn in as CEO of the Millennium Challenge Corporation in December of 2009 and brings more than 30 years of experience in banking and economic development to this role. Born in Ethiopia, he brings a deep personal understanding of the imperative of spurring broad-based economic development in Africa and other frontier markets around the world. As head of an agency whose mission is to reduce poverty through sustainable development, he's well positioned to open our discussion today on the synergies between public and private investment in development. So please join me in welcoming the Honorable Daniel Yohannes to the podium.
Good morning. Many thanks to Jennifer from the Initiative for Global Development for the kind introduction, and Kamal from the Brookings Institution for hosting us here today. I'm also grateful for the opportunity to join such distinguished panelists, Tim, Chad, and Justin, for this discussion. And I'm pleased to join you this morning to discuss a topic near and dear to my heart, the role of business in development. I come from the banking and finance industry that help Americans and businesses create wealth and achieve the American dream. One of the attractions that drew me to the Millennium Challenge Corporation was that MCC takes a business-like approach and applies it to development assistance. One of my top priorities as CEO of the Millennium Challenge Corporation is to leverage private sector partnership to promote economic growth and reduce poverty in well-governed, poor countries. The reason is simple. Foreign assistance on its own, no matter how well it's managed or no matter how much money is poured to partner countries, will never be the engine for widespread economic growth. What will make a difference on a sustained basis are free market fueled by private enterprise. The private sector, after all, is the engine of innovation, job creation, and growth. Private businesses are already providing 84% of the resource flow to developing countries. 60% of Fortune 100 companies are engaged in development partnerships. International finance institutions are exploring opportunities to leverage their investment dollars in frontier and emerging markets. At MCC, we are making significant efforts to increase prosperity by investing more than $7 billion in 19 countries around the world. Yet, we recognize we can do much more by partnering with the private sector and better leveraging our capital. For example, I just returned from El Salvador, where I saw a public-private partnership at work. In the northern part of the country, the Salvadoran government, MCC, and Virginia-based AES Corporation combine efforts on a $33 million public-private partnership. This partnership provides 21,000 Salvadoran households access to electricity for the first time. Because of the private sector's involvement, routine maintenance, operating cost recovery, and yes, profit will assure sustainable access to power in this remote region of the country. In addition, AES Corporation is growing its paying customer base and has become a key partner in improving the quality of life for Salvadorans. The people I met told me how they were able to replace kerosene. As you know, kerosene is very dangerous for your health. Of course, now they have electricity. They have lights for the kids to study at night and also run some appliances that have been there for some time, sent by American friends and their relatives who lived here in this country for some time. Yet bringing electricity to region does more than make life more comfortable. It opens up a wealth of possibilities for small businesses and feeds entrepreneurial spirit. I also witnessed the growing role of business in development during my recent visit to Ghana. MCC's investment throughout the entire agricultural value chain, from cold storage facilities to technical training to access to credit programs to major roads, have become a magnet for businesses in Ghana. We want to make sure that potential investors know that by the time our investments mature, Ghana will be a more reliable supplier of globally 35 fruits and vegetables. There will be improved irrigation and post-harvest infrastructure, and as many as 60,000 export-ready farmers will be trained to meet global market demand. Chiquita and Dole, both American companies, for example, have noticed and have begun sourcing trial shipments of pineapples from MCC-supported farms. VegPro, a company from Kenya, is preparing to export vegetables from Ghana to Europe by working with MIRA, the local entity responsible for implementing Ghana's compact. VegPro is now leasing 250 hectares of land next to MCC irrigation facilities. VegPro will be providing farmers with direct employment from its own farm, as well as sourcing vegetables to MCC-supported farmers. Over the next 4 years, it's my understanding that they're going to be able to expand their operations to increase additional capacity, additional income for the farmers, and possibly a better standard of living, and possibly the farmers or the income grow would be able to buy American products and services to create additional businesses right here at home. What I saw in Ghana and El Salvador reaffirms for me the strong multiplier effect of private sector engagement. One of the most effective ways to make our investments sustainable is to provide MCC countries with the tools, resources, and information they need to attract, develop, and sustain partnership with the private sector. This approach reinforces MCC's country ownership model and dovetails with a partner country's own growth strategy. On many levels, MCC have been working to expand the private sector multiplier effect. First, we are working hard to create an attractive environment for the private sector investment. Tying the award of MCC's development dollars to a country's policy performance creates a very strong incentive for reform. In Nicaragua, for example, before MCC's investment, the country was maintaining an average of 500 kilometers and spending only $2.4 million per year in annual road maintenance budget. Through our advice and counsel, the government established a permanent road maintenance fund. Nicaragua is now maintaining more than 2,700 kilometers and spending over $25 million per year on a yearly basis. In Armenia, where we are helping the Armenians, the sector, the infrastructure there, primarily the what you call the sector that provides a lot of water, irrigation project, if you will, was previously owned by the state. After we negotiated with the Armenian government, that infrastructure is being turned to the private sector, which had the knowledge and is more efficiently that could run the projects. These are some of the examples of MCC's ability to achieve significant policy changes that create new opportunities for private sector firms. This kind of policy reform makes our investments more effective and paves the way for private investors to operate more efficiently in MCC partner countries. Partnering with MCC practically gives countries a seal of sound investment approval. I want to make sure that seal is real. Second, we are working to facilitate more investment opportunities around the projects we fund. We encourage private sector and businesses, those domestic and international, to add to and complement MCC's initial investments through their own financing, technical expertise, and innovative operations. This is why MCC insists that the private sector get involved and remain involved in developing and implementing MCC projects. Additional private sector investments can turn our initial investments into economically productive assets. MCC has launched an agribusiness development initiative, for example, to bring private businesses to the table to complement existing commercial activity throughout the value chains of MCC projects. The initiative aimed at investment promotion is being piloted first in Morocco and Ghana, both MCC partner countries. We can already point to VegPro's cooperation with MCC-supported farmers in Ghana as an example of the progress we are making. Third, we are working to bring the expertise and experience of the private sector to bear much earlier in our decision-making processes. While I'm very proud of the work that has been done at MCC so far to engage the private sector in our investments, my sense is that too often this partnership has been retrofitted to existing operations rather than designed right from the beginning. I would like to change this approach now, and we are taking several steps in that direction. We need to be more proactive internally with partner countries to include the private sector from the very beginning of the design stage, while countries analyze the constraints to economic development. MCC partner countries can learn best practices from the private sector. Solicit information about technology solutions to identified growth constraints. Discuss leveraging opportunities. We need to explore better ways of integrating private sector partners in MCC's peer review of the proposed projects countries ask us to fund. And once projects are approved, we need to aggressively publicize procurement opportunities for businesses to bid on during the implementation of MCC compacts. MCC's $7 billion global investment generates procurement opportunities that are real, sizable, worth your attention in frontier markets. In Africa alone, MCC investing more than $5 billion, 60% of which supports infrastructure development and agricultural productivity. We invite the private sector to consider procurements resulting directly from the implementation of MCC-funded projects. While we have made progress, our sights are set on doing more to help partner countries achieve their development goals through private sector-led growth. We are still thinking through all the dynamics. That's why we are taking a pragmatic country-by-country, project-by-project approach and seeking partnerships with the private sector that leverage additional resources for development, enhance returns on investments, and improve the efficiency and sustainability of our programs. MCC is committed to intensifying private sector engagement in more sophisticated and sustainable ways. Looking ahead, our plans call for this at the transactional level. Achieving our mission of poverty reduction through economic growth requires targeted partnering, which will enable us to increase the scope and scale of our investments and address development challenges. Allocate, mitigate risk for investors and other market participants, and accelerate the transfer of technical or managerial expertise into a developing market. We're also exploring new development partnerships, from standalone investments to parallel and co-investments that will be commercially viable and sustainable. We are looking at innovative ways to apply existing successful investment models to frontier markets, involve non-traditional investment partners like NGOs, social investors, foundations, and other donors, and deliver economic and social development returns. As we look for better ways to leverage the private sector There are certain things MCC will not do. We will not take the easy road and cherry-pick the best projects, those that the private sector should and could be financing directly in the first place. We want to crowd in, not crowd out, the private sector. We will not subsidize the private sector. We will not displace the good work of others, particularly those the U.S. government, like OPEC and the U.S. Trade and Development Agency, but rather work to create synergies and look for a more distinct, more MCC role in this important space. And I welcome discussing ways we can uniquely deepen private sector involvement in development. As part of our conversation, I would submit the following questions to you today. How can we gain a better understanding of the specific constraints companies face to investing in the sectors that MCC countries are more interested in developing? What innovative approaches can we use to manage and mitigate risk for businesses working with us towards sustainable development? What approaches can we encourage countries to use, including providing risk capital to entrepreneurs to stimulate more innovation on the part of the local private sector? How can we access new sources of capital that are interested in both financial and social returns? As U2's lead singer and poverty reduction champion Bono reminded us in his op-ed in the New York Times a few weeks ago, smart aid can be a reforming tool, demanding accountability and transparency, rewarding measurable results, and reinforcing the rule of law, but never imagining for a second that it is a substitute for trade, investment, or self-determination. The sustainable development so many poor communities seek would not come from handouts of assistance. Rather, change will come when we use our development resources as a springboard to empower entrepreneurs, attract businesses and investors, and ignite the engine for marketed-led growth. This is why the Millennium Challenge Corporation is committed to deepening our engagement with the private sector, so together we can invest in programs that offers opportunity, hope, and prosperity for the world's poor. Today's event provides a perfect forum for us businesses and government, think tanks, and NGOs to share ideas and learn from one another. I'm looking forward to the discussion, and thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Daniel. This was wonderful, and you also helped even more by already setting out some of the key questions the panel will discuss. I also want to thank very much Jennifer Potter, the President and CEO of the Initiative for Global Development, for co-hosting this with us. Let me just say a few words before introducing the extraordinary panel we have today. Looking at the world, you know, things are changing dramatically and very quickly. And it's true that when we look at the developing countries as a whole, from Asia to Latin America to Africa, everybody together, the average growth rate has been almost twice as fast over the last decade than the rich countries, and the projections that the IMF just released last week are for them to grow maybe three times as fast as the rich countries. So the world economy is shifting, and there's a lot of growth, a lot of wealth creation, a lot of demand coming from the developing countries. At the same time, we do have to remember that there are still 2.5 billion very, very poor people in those countries. 1 billion of them extremely poor. So while all this is happening, the development task is still there. The misery in which many people are trapped is still with us despite all these positive developments. And I think the fight against poverty has to go on. What is happening, what is very helpful, of course, is that there are these pools of growth throughout the world. So the partnerships for the private sector, the entry points for the private sector have become stronger, I think. I think you all have experience of this, but even in the poorest countries of Africa, one sees these signs of growth. In certain locations, in certain sectors, it's not yet widespread enough, but it's there. And I think that strengthens the opportunities for public-private partnerships. and I think will allow the private sector, both the domestic national private sector, but also the international private sector, to come in with even more force and more resources in the decade that's ahead. We have a fantastic panel today, and I'm really very grateful on behalf of both IGD and Brookings for you to have taken the time to join us today. Justin Chinyanta is the Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of the Deloitte Group. Mr. Chinyanta is a leader with deep knowledge in the financial markets, particularly of Eastern and Southern Africa, with over 20 years of professional experience in commercial investment banking in the region. He is Executive Vice President of the Southern Africa Chapter of the Africa Business Roundtable and has been appointed on the export roster of the UN Institute for the Training and Research in Debt, Financial Management and Negotiation Programs. Chad Holliday is the former chairman and CEO of DuPont, having retired from the position very recently in 2009. Under Holliday's leadership, DuPont established a goal of achieving sustainable growth, increasing shareholder and societal value, while simultaneously decreasing DuPont's carbon footprint. Mr. Holliday currently serves as an executive in residence at Vanderbilt University Business School and chairman emeritus of the Council on Competitiveness. And Tim Solso is Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Cummins. Under his leadership, Cummins has grown into a Fortune 250 company that designs, produces, and sells diesel engines, power generation equipment, and related components worldwide. Tim also serves as Chairman of Cummins Foundation, one of the oldest corporate foundations in the country, which is focused on supporting environmental, educational, and social justice initiatives in the communities where Cummins operates. So thank you very much, all of you, for being with us. Now, Daniel already posed some questions. I don't know whether you took notes during the speech or not, but certainly these are key questions. And what the Millennium Challenge Corporation has done, particularly in the recent years, is really quite impressive. I visited some of the programs while I was still at UNDP, particularly in Morocco and in Ghana, and the whole approach of letting it be driven by national initiative, by partnership with the private sector, but also by putting in critical mass. The resources are not insignificant. And I think, giving a big push to some of these countries, I think is beginning to work quite well. But we've been hit by the crisis worldwide. And I think the whole relationship between the private sector, governments, markets, regulations is still debated. And maybe we can start by that, asking the panel how you see these relationship. I think there's a general agreement in this room and among specialists from all over the world that, as Daniel Johannes said, the private sector has to be the driving force. Without the private sector being the driving force, it doesn't work. It's not sustainable, even if one can generate help for needy people in a temporary way. Unless the self-sustaining private sector investment process takes hold, it won't be sustainable. At the same time, government has a role. There is the need to somehow manage risk. Daniel Johannes said we won't subsidize the private sector. I think that's a good principle. But you do carry some of the risk. You have the non-market risk. The private sector cannot take the political risks that still exist. On average, rates of return are very high in developing countries. They're actually higher than in rich countries, but that's true on average. There's a big variance in that average. So the pooling of risk can play a very important role. So maybe we can start with Justin, and then Chad, and then Tim, if you want to address these questions or anything that you want to put on the table.
Thank you, Kamal. I think the first issue we have to look at is, the architecture with which we're working. I would speak specifically about Africa because that's my expertise. I have, over the last 25 years, worked at Citibank and HSBC, in various capacities before setting out with my own boutique investment bank and our investment company to invest across Africa. In this endeavor, I have been to about 47 of the 54 African countries. So I think I am on fairly safe ground when I start with that. When we look at Africa, I think the key starting point would be looking at the Africa Competitiveness Report, which is a product of the African Development Bank, a product of the World Bank, and a product of the World Economic Forum. And in that report, there's in the preamble some very simple words which would appear to be baffling to some of us. The words are, the only reliable way to reduce poverty in Africa is to set the economy into a path of positive long-term growth. Now, it sounds almost like a tautology, but it is something that is absolutely critical and fundamental. Because what we're dealing with in Africa, and Africa, here I will again hasten to add, is consistent of 54 African countries, is that there is a political framework in some instances which we cannot assume or presume will be present. And then before you even go to the economic framework, which is the basis on which the long-term economic growth will be assured. So really, I think from my perspective, one of the critical things that we have to look at is how the foreign aid that is going into the continent and the investment that is going into the continent is playing its role in creating sustainable political systems as well, in terms of systems that produce good governance, systems that produce accountability, systems that have a respect for the rule of law, et cetera, et cetera, on the one hand. Because that is really the starting point before we even get to the economic standpoint. Because, Kamal, you have been in Morocco and in Ghana, and I think I stand on safe ground when I say that there are some failing and failed states. Somalia is an example from which we are all sort of not even pondering or thinking about. Zimbabwe is another which is failing in itself, but which is trying to pull itself very, ably out of its difficult predicament. But the problem is that these countries have a knock-on effect, Zimbabwe onto Zambia and into South Africa and into the regional countries, Somalia, last month I was in Kenya, into the activities that Al-Shabaab is carrying out in the region, and, the piracy issues that are creating non-state actors who are now becoming an issue again for the so-called security and safety and security measures that we're talking about. So as I see it, it is critical when the U.S. government and other players are thinking of aid to the continent to first of all look at the political architecture that is in place or that can be in place and how it can be improved and how it can be strengthened. There are several initiatives that have been undertaken by people like the African Union, credibly some of them like the New Partnership for African Development, NEPAD framework, is a framework which has created the African Peer Review Mechanism, and the African Peer Review Mechanism in turn is a framework which has created certain perspectives in which African countries are relooking at themselves from a perspective of governance and good governance being critical. So I think there are some initiatives which are there and which should be encouraged in the political architecture. So even before we actually say, look, from the aid side, our aid is going into infrastructure or into health or into education, let's look at how the aid is going to support that side of things. Now, assuming that political architecture is in place, then there are six conditionalities, as I see it, or six factors which are discussed, particularly in the Africa Competitiveness Report. This is the importance of good policies, consistent policies by the governments towards us players in the private sector, because as you may know, in some of our countries, we will have policies that give too much discretion to one particular player or too much monopoly to another particular player, and therefore will harm or accordingly encourage private investment. There is the access to finance constraint, which has been discussed earlier by Honorable Daniel, and which continues, I think, to be a key buffer constraint. Then, of course, there is an infrastructure issue. In some cases, I think I was reading one World Bank report, which states that as much as 30% in costs, of total costs of production could of eventual total costs to sales could eventually be the a result of the poor infrastructure that one is operating in. Although in the infrastructure space, again, one would look at both the opportunity and the opportunity posed by those particular constraints, as has happened with the telecom space, for instance, where you have had the private sector very successfully investing, and where we have seen a pan-African investment in the form of especially South Africa going out into the rest of Africa, and Orascom in North Africa coming down. And then finally, it is important also to talk about some success stories, because it's very interesting that we talk about all these aid that we might be putting in and all this investment that might be going in, but where are the success stories? Those success stories, I would hesitate to mention, will probably lead into my own question for the panel, which is how really the international private sector sees as its own role in the development of a vibrant domestic private sector. Because the domestic private sector is the one that ultimately will create sustenance and sustainable development. I'll stop there for now.
Thank you very much, Justin. Maybe I'll turn to Chad now. You've had tremendous experience from in all over the world. How do you see these issues, and particularly the interaction between the public and the private spheres?
That's great. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I'll come across as a large business opportunity in Africa, probably the largest one opportunity we see anywhere in the world from our DuPont perspective. I'll be an advocate for partnering with NGOs. And let me just share with you one example that's almost 20 years old, but has tremendously impacted the way DuPont thinks about entering developing countries, particularly Africa. So when the Carter Foundation, President Jimmy Carter, came to us and said there's a terrible problem with the guinea worm in Africa, and you're a chemical company, you can get some chemicals that can go fix this. And we were challenged by that, and it took the normal course of looking at it. And, of course, you can find some chemicals that could kill the guinea worm, but then you look at handling those chemicals safely, turned out to be a much bigger problem than you could imagine. So we went back to President Carter and said, well, we can't do that. He said, you're really smart people. You can figure something out. And he's very persuasive. And so our scientists looked at it and said, well, if we could find a way to filter the water, because it's in the drinking water, after it comes out of the well, that doesn't run the risk of the chemicals. And then our big concern was, how would you ever teach everybody to do that? But we think we can do it. So we took nylon and we found a particular way to weave it so we could make a filter. We actually got our customers. If we provide the nylon, they would weave the cloth. And the only issue was, how do you train everybody now to use this, even though it could be done safely? And that's what really moved us, because that's where the Carter Foundation came in. And the president personally went and met with the presidents of each country, got them involved. He put people from the foundation on the ground to train people how to use it and train the networks of people how to use it. And lo and behold, 3.5 years later, we were at 1/10 the level of guinea worm that we were before. And so the impact that had on our company, we didn't actually sell anything, but what we understood was there is a way to communicate, there is a way to get things done, people are very capable, and we built networks inside the Carter Foundation that 3 years later, we wanted to know how to go into country A, we knew who to go call. And so what I would say is those experiences are very critical, because I think you have to have companies feel some success on the ground, then to come back, as we have, maybe we can talk later, about our agriculture business has been very important to us.
Thank you very much. This is one of the most successful interventions that you know, is in all the textbooks now. And really, congratulations for this. I was at the Carter Library actually on Friday giving a lecture, and it's a beautiful place. And I'm really so impressed by what President Carter has done over the years. But this partnership, you know, I think probably without the prodding, you might not have gotten into it, but certainly without you, it wouldn't have happened. So I think it's a wonderful example of this kind of partnership. Tim, I turn to you now.
First of all, I would agree that business investment and business development is the driver. It can be supported by aid, but successful businesses create employment. The second point, general point I would make, is that businesses go to developing countries and invest because they think they'll get a return on that investment, that the outcomes of more employment, better education, economic development for those countries happens because the business is successful. Businesses do not go to places just to do good, and we need to be clear about that. I thought what I would do is describe Cummins' model in terms of how we go into developing countries. And one thing is that it has to be a very, very long-term perspective. And if we think that you're going to get quarterly returns or annual returns, it just doesn't happen that way. We went into India in 1962. We have about 12 businesses there today and about $1.7 billion of revenue. We went into China in 1975. We again have about 12 businesses there and revenues of $2.3 billion. We went into Brazil in 1972. It's about $900 million today, and we went into Russia about 5 or 6 years ago. When we go into those countries, in every single case, we don't go alone. We find joint venture partners, whether it be customers that manufacture equipment that our engines go in, or distribution systems. But our model is that we just will not operate in a country without having really, really good partners and knowing how to operate. Right now, we are looking at our Africa strategy. I've spent 5 weeks in Africa this year visiting 7 countries. It's not the same as 47 countries that Justin's visited, but I know a little bit now just to be dangerous. And I see the same opportunities. I think that some of the countries connected together in Africa will be the fifth brick. I don't see in the 5 weeks that I was there, including our own company, anybody that has a consistent and effective strategy in terms of how we're going about it. All of us have 3 manufacturing facilities in South Africa, joint ventures in Nigeria and Ghana, but we have partners from Europe rather than Africans. Our distribution system is not consistent with the way trade and commerce flows in Africa. So we need to go back in there and really think through where we want to invest, who we want to invest with, and see what that opportunity is. Now, after we go into these markets over a long period of time, and we generate profits, we have an obligation in terms of corporate responsibility to invest back in those communities. We've had a belief for a long period of time that a corporation and its employees are only as healthy as the communities in which we operate. Therefore, it's in our best interest to make those communities the best they can possibly be. And to use a couple of examples that are very similar, for example, the foundation funded in India a rural electrification project where we converted a generator set to run on the equivalent of vegetable oil, and this was produced by seeds from an indigenous tree in the area. And the people collected the seeds, sold the seeds, generated some money, were able to buy the electricity, and then this produced electricity in a village that had 65 homes that had never had electricity before. In Senegal, we did it a little bit differently in the sense that it was wind, solar, and then backed up by a diesel generator set. This provided electricity in a place that had not had it before for 700 people. And when you see this, one, that is doing good, but it also creates an economic opportunity for our corporation. And when you see people that have not had electricity and their kids can start to read at night and study for school, it's a life-changing kind of thing. So you start with the idea that you can make a profit, you go in with partners, you behave in a responsible way, and you invest back in that community.
Could I ask just, Tim, one follow-up question here? You know, how is it that you're able to take such a long-term view? And maybe I'll, to all of you, particularly from, I mean, there is often in modern, particularly the financial sector in modern business, this short-termism which we all are struggling with, and yet you seem to be able to take really the long-term view. And in development, one really has to take the long-term view. One can't just be driven by 3 months, 6 months, or even 1 or 2 year kind of horizons. So how do you manage that?
I think you have to have a portfolio of businesses so that some that are mature are producing or generating profits that meet the objectives of the street, which allows you to invest in longer-term projects. You can't just have long-term projects and not generate anything in the short term. But I'll give you an example in India, where we have a joint venture with Tata, and we build a plant with a capacity of 120,000 engines for trucks and buses. We made absolutely no money over 10 years there. Today we're building a second plant with a similar capacity and earning good money. But some of us were criticized severely in the sense that, you know, you're not making any money. But if you think you've got the right partner and you can see that that market is going to be big at some point in day, you hang in there. And so I think it's on a case-by-case basis. You can't sacrifice the short term, but if you have that balance, then I think you can take a long-term perspective. And if you don't take a long-term perspective, I don't think you're going to be successful. Some people have gone into developing markets and done acquisitions. Some have insisted to go it alone, but that's been a policy. And in my experience, I've seen that it be less effective than going in with local partners and taking the long-term perspective.
You know, in this context, from the macro, and I'm going to ask, maybe go back to Daniel, maybe to ask something also from a, you know, U.S. aid strategy on this short-term, long-term issue, and then turn back to you. But one thing that is very striking in the macro statistics when one looks at development, you know, the countries that are growing so fast in emerging Asia are saving, and I'm not talking about China. China is a very special case. The system is special. They're saving 50% of their income or more. But India went from a savings rate, national savings rate, of 20, 21% to a national savings rate of 35, 36%. And obviously, that is a reflection of people thinking longer term, willing to take some short-term sacrifice to get long-term return. Unfortunately, many developing countries are still, you know, 18, 20% savings rate, which is not really enough to generate the critical mass of self-financing investments that we need. So I think this long-term, short-term horizon is very, very important, and the success stories of Asia, there are other factors which explain it, but one factor clearly is the ability of these East Asians to take the long-term view. Daniel, do you want to say something on this from a MCC or U.S. government perspective?
Yeah, thank you very much. A couple of things. Number one, all of our investments are primarily made with an assumption that's going to be a long-term sustainable growth opportunities. For example, our $7 billion investment is expected to generate something like $9 billion over a 20-year period. And we work with countries that are committed to good governance, for example, by making business opportunities extremely attractive. These are countries that are committed to good governance, countries that are committed to fighting corruption, countries that are committed to controlling inflation. In fact, Kamala was in Cape Verde about 2 months ago, and what I saw is the country, because of his commitment to creating business opportunities in the long term, were able to reduce the amount of time it took from 59 days to less than an hour to start a business in the country. So we've been able also to leverage a lot of our investment opportunities in those countries by making them change some of the policies to make sure that they continue to be attractive for businesses in the long term. So with that, Kamal, again, we have a long-term view of our investments. It's not short-term. In some cases, it gets in trouble with our funders because they expect short-term results. But nevertheless, right now, for example, the government is looking, the Obama administration, that is, how to link development aid with trade investments, if you will, so that at least it's long-lasting and it could bring about prosperity much sooner than what has been done in the past through the PSD program, in which we've been very actively engaged by participating as well as providing information about lessons learned in the last 5 years. Also, MCC happens to be the major contributor. Approximately 70% of our investment dollars go for aid to trade activities based on my most recent data that I have. The same thing is true like in Ghana, where I was Kamal. They've used about 50% of their investment, primarily in the long-term economic growth, primarily starting from the farming production as well as to including many of the infrastructure, if we will, that will transport and bring long-term economic prosperity throughout the value chain. So we're looking in terms of long-term, not short-term. And like I said, sometimes it gets us in trouble. Nevertheless, that's probably one of the best ways to accomplish our goals.
Thank you. Chad, do you want to add anything?
I'd go back to your question to Tim about how do companies look at going into developing countries. In DuPont, and I was stationed in Asia for 6 years, and had the job of implementing this. We actually have a model we put against every country about GDP, where the GDP is, technology leadership, formal governance. So we can not only read the country, but we read which wave of DuPont products are right now. One of the biggest things, if you bring it very advanced and the market's not there to take it, the customers aren't there, you'll be very disappointed. And so we know which wave to bring in. So the first thing we tend to bring in is agriculture. So today, about a third of DuPont sales are either in seeds or chemicals to improve the productivity of agriculture. And we found in Africa that was one of the first things we had to bring in. We also found that our data could sometimes be wrong. So a very simple example, we looked at what the price was for seed when the farmer wasn't growing the seed themselves. They were buying it from somebody else. What price were they paying? And we looked at that and said, that business model won't work. We cannot make money at that price. And so the first reaction of the team was, we're not going to win. Then we sent another team back in to look. And when they looked, they came back and said, oh, you don't realize what's happening. It's all hand planted. And they poke a hole in the ground and they put three seeds in because you need to get three to get one to come up. So the difference was ours come up the first time with one seed. So we could actually go in with a pricing model that made sense once we showed people our seeds would actually come up. And actually have a profitable business that actually equal our average margin around the world. But it's not until you got on the ground and saw what was really happening that you can be misled. And the last piece is we moved into biotechnology, both for agriculture and for materials. We found that it's a new science. It's something misunderstood. There's a lot of people that have real concerns about the use of the technology. And so we had a biotechnology advisory board. Well, the typical thing is you get real scientists, maybe a lawyer. We put this group together, and we have a priest, and we have a couple people from Africa. Because what it's people at the table advising you that understand how the technology is used and how you introduce it so it's well-received properly is very important. So my last piece of advice is be sure you have people from country, be able to cut through the chatter of the normal levels to give advice in what you're doing.
Thank you very much. And I think when you explain that, the waves of products. I'm a macroeconomist, so I tend to know the macro figures, but, it is very interesting that projections are that much more than half of all new demand in the world economy is going to come from developing countries. So when you think of it from a business point of view, that's quite dramatic. It wasn't the case 20 years ago, even 10 years ago. It could be two-thirds, but I'm saying at least half. And that's a lot. Now, Justin, one thing that's particularly important, I think, in Africa, but more generally, is the size of the market and the fact that so many developing countries are quite small, quite fragmented. The infrastructure is not really linking them up. And in my experience working on development, and particularly in Africa, it's been one of the big obstacles. Are you feeling that?
That's an interesting point. Let's say about 20 years ago, what you're saying is certainly correct. But several initiatives have since taken place, which are notable initiatives. For instance, about 1986, the preferential trade area was set up, which basically groups countries in about 23 African markets, all the way from Egypt down to Swaziland in the south. And then what you have is that it has eventually evolved into something called the Common Market for Eastern and Southern Africa, COMESA. By that approach, they have managed to create a market of about, if I'm not wrong, about 350 million Africans, all the way from Egypt down to Swaziland. They have managed to agree on tariffs, in terms of a common tariff structure. They have managed in that way to also improve the perception, for instance, of a small country like Malawi going out rather than going through the common market to be seen as a viable investment tool. The same has been happening in the Southern African area. There's something called the Southern Africa Development Community, which South Africa is very much a prime mover on. And that groups about 12 countries together. And in fact, I think by 2016, they intend to have a common monetary policy for the area, which will make things like cross-border issues of bonds and paper and securities much, much easier, let alone payment in terms of marketing payments. So I think the response really has been, there's been something happening in the regional integration space, which is important to watch, because on the West African side, they have the same thing with ECOWAS. I think you're probably aware of that. And each of them are actually now seeing themselves as competitive zones. So the Southern African Development Community is trying to move much faster than, say, ECOWAS in commonizing their policies so that they can have a much bigger market for people to look at.
Thank you very much for sharing that. And I think it is important that these markets integrate, that there's movement, free movement, as free movement as possible of goods, services. People is always harder, but, I think people also have to be able to move more freely. Absolutely. There are, of course, tough issues. Do you adopt a common currency zone, for example, or not? I hate to think of the European problems with their currency zone in Africa, but anyway, that's a different topic. So things are not that simple, unfortunately. In economics, they never are. But as Justin said, there has been quite a bit of movement in Africa to create more unity, to create more a bigger size of the market, to harmonize the taxes and tariffs. And I think a lot more can be done, particularly also on infrastructure, on infrastructure linking, transport infrastructure linking the African countries. But things are happening, and I think that will create further business opportunities. So maybe what we'll do now is open the discussion to the floor. And if I could ask participants to very briefly, when they raise their hand, also introduce themselves and direct their question either at the panel in general or at one member of the panel. And we might perhaps take two or three questions as a group and then come back to the panel. Yes?
Sorry. My name is Randall Kempner, and I run the ASPA Network of Development Entrepreneurs. And I share the hypothesis that I think all of you have said, which business can and should be the main driver of economic development. But business has been involved in development for a long time. And it's not always been involved with positive results. You mentioned bananas. There were banana republics earlier last century. And the Washington Consensus, which talked about privatization and liberalization, has led to mixed results. So the question is, what is new today about businesses' involvement in development, and why are you optimistic that it will be successful?
Very good question. Yes, gentleman here.
Hugh Grindstaff. How do you see your our investment in Africa coming up against China, and they're going into the countries, even the Saudi Arabia, who are making farms to grow crops to send back to Saudi Arabia. Aren't we up against some mighty foes?
Thank you very much. Yes, I'll go in the back, because the back always sometimes gets disadvantaged, so I will try to. Yes, go ahead.
Hi, my name's Heather Stewart. I'm with NAFSA, the Association of International Educators. My question speaks to education, and you need a human capital development plan as well. And what role does higher education, tertiary education, and providing more access to that in developing nations, whether within home countries or without, outside?
Thank you. I'll take, I think, maybe one more. In the back there. Right. I'll take you afterwards. Then we have five, and then we'll come back to the panel.
Richard America, Georgetown University Business School. I'm tagging along with that. We've created in the SADC region a network of all the business schools in the whole SADC region, partnering with the University of Botswana and the University of Pretoria. And the idea is that weak management is a key constraint. And if we improve business schools, we'll improve management, and that will help accelerate development. So if Cummins or DuPont, Bank of America, MCC really want to do something that will have major impact at a relatively small investment, invest in graduate business schools, and you'll have a big payoff.
All right. And gentleman here, yes?
Hi, Stephen Dahl with Ridgehill Consulting. One of the stories to follow up on Randall's question that's missing here is extractive industries, which are responsible for a big part of the optimistic-looking bump in investment, and yet often enough they seem willing to have bad political environments and, you know, not give back social impact into these communities.
All right, I think we'll go back to the panel now, and let me just maybe summarize. I think there are three main points raised. One is, you know, the history of business development partnerships, including long-ago history, sometimes of business involvements and contracts with regimes, you know, that were not really bent on development, some contracts signed which were not really to the advantage of the developing country, and, you know, we can all think of some. So what has changed to make that partnership much more promising, much more beneficial to the recipient country, including particularly in the extractive industries, where some of the worst examples were in the past? Then there was a question on the new actors, China being the most important one, but India also coming up. How do you perceive that? How does the U.S. perceive it also, you know? And how do we see it from a development perspective? And then the third two questions relating really to education, the role of skills, education, and there was a lot of emphasis by the World Bank, the UN, and all of us on primary and secondary education, I think probably correct emphasis. But there is a little bit of a stress now on also on higher education and the role of universities, of management skills, and so on. So that was the third point, if you like. Why don't we start with Chad? You were
so on the first question. Our experience in DuPont is we would have a particular opportunity in a developing country, and we bring it back into the U.S. in corporate headquarters, that is a good way to kill something very fast, because it just does not fit the equation people are used to working with. And struggling with that about 8 years ago, we changed it, and we gave it to a Brazilian located in Sao Paulo, and we gave him a budget, and he formed the network around all the other developing countries, and he decided, without ever having to tell headquarters what he was doing, you know, which projects to get funded and how they got funded. It was the most successful thing we've ever done. And so I just say is it's on the ground, not having the filters, asking different sets of questions. And also we didn't fund a lot, too, but it was a unique thing, and I would really recommend, you know, companies considering that. Second, from our personal work with DuPont in Tokyo, where UN University is, we found a program they had of solving problems of having a network of a couple thousand scientists located throughout the world, where they send the problem out, and they ask for 10 solutions, and they get solutions. They iterate back and forth over about a 100-day period, and they come out with a solution that was public. Nobody was going to make any, you know, intellectual property on it. It was out. We got to look at them and say, where did the best answers come from? They tended consistently to come from educated people in developing countries. Because something about the solution set you come up with when you don't have as many resources around you is very different. And so we shifted that, so we start expecting much more from our developing countries in DuPont, not just tell us about the market, but we tried to place very well-educated people coming up with solutions to problems in that perspective.
Tim,
do you want to say something on any of these questions?
Okay, I'll try and, if I can remember them, I'll try and hit a little bit on each of them. On what's different, I'm not sure I can say something specifically is different, but I can describe that I'm involved with a CEO forum with Brazil. There's 10 CEOs from Brazil and 10 from the U.S. And we looked at what corporate responsibility initiatives both sides had in Brazil. And there was 100% of those businesses were actively investing in the communities and causes, taking, again, the long-term point of view. I think also, at least building on what Chad said, if your strategy is that you're going to have Africans run Africa and Indians run India and so forth, the citizens of those countries have that understanding, and it's not run by a bunch of expatriates that, you know, may have a different set of agenda. So I am optimistic. It does not mean that we will not see egregious behaviors and that type of thing, but I am optimistic that there are more companies thinking that way of the long-term investment. And again, I go back to the belief that if you don't develop your communities and make them the best they can be, then you're really taking some risks that are not very smart. In terms of China and others investing in Africa and Latin and South America, it is quite remarkable. And I think that there could be, I don't know for sure, a limited window of opportunity. And I think the U.S. government needs to really be much more aggressive on the trade agenda. And right now, primarily because of the recession or perhaps other things, there's a wave of protectionism and a belief on that that is limiting free trade agreements, Doha bilateral and tax treaties, bilateral investment treaties, and so forth. And the more that we can do that and promote trade, the more economic development we'll get in developing countries. And finally, on the education, I think that's a really terrific point because my own view, having spent the 5 weeks in Africa, the single biggest challenge we have will be finding leaders, skilled technicians all up and down. And if we're going to do it, we, the company, will have to take a much bigger role. We've already hired an individual that will put together a recruiting plan. But to give you an example, if we know a mine site is going to open, or they're going to start today, they won't start mining for 6 years. And it takes 6 years to train a technician to be at the mine to monitor and service the engines that are there. So those folks are rare or don't exist. So we know we're going to have to develop training schools, you know, for that sets of. We also know that there are Africans living in Europe and living in the United States that want to go back to Africa, and finding mechanisms for them to do that. We have just in our headquarters 26 Africans that were buried in our organization. And some of those want to go back, so we need to do development programs in that way. Again, policy, the immigration policy the United States has today doesn't work in this kind of environment because we can't move people back and forth freely. And it takes time, it's cumbersome. This is in terms of hiring people in Africa, either working in the headquarters or supporting them for some higher education and having them go back. It makes it very difficult. So in terms of public policy, that's an area that, I think we should be advocates for positive change.
Justin?
Yeah. Okay, I'll take the two questions. What's different on the human capacity issues? I think what's different, to some extent, was answered by the second questioner's perspective. What's different is that there are players who are now looking at the African, let's say in Africa, again, I'm going back to Africa, at the African continent as a market in its own right, as a very serious market in its own right. You've got South Africa, for instance, looking at mining and the telecom sector very aggressively investing. You've got Brazil coming in into the mining sector in its former and the energy sector in its former Lusophone countries. You've got China, of course, the China effect. It doesn't matter which side of the spectrum you're on. The effects of what they're doing is visible. I mean, in Congo, a country which only had 500 miles of tarred roads when President Mobutu left about 10 years ago, the Chinese by next year would have built 10,000 kilometers of roads. Now, building a road changes a whole perspective in terms of both the human health issues, education issues, and just human-to-human issues. What's different is that there are players that are looking at that market both as a market of commodities and as a market for selling into Africa on a serious basis. Now, on the the capacity issues, there's actually one success story I would quote here, which is Citibank. Citibank has always had a very positive African alumni, if you will. In fact, last year, they held a conference in London where about 400 of these guys turned up. And these are people that they have invested in, as Tim was saying. I'm one of those. They've taken time to cultivate, to train in very, very difficult financial concepts and structures, and then loose them onto the African continent itself. So I think, when we considering the private sector's role, there are some things that the private sector itself can do in its own interest. Now, Citibank hasn't done that because it's an esoteric motion or from its perspective, it thinks that maybe they will get some value in the at some future point. One is they get immediate value in terms of the managerial acumen that they have. But secondly, and more importantly, this was a business that I was actually involved with. They developed the whole of their financial institutions correspondent banking business on the back of that. What they did is basically they trained other bankers to think in the Citibank way, and therefore those bankers would bank with Citibank. And that business, as of the time that I left the bank anyway, had moved from a business that was making about $5 million a year to a business that was making hundreds of millions of dollars a year. So there are ways and there are approaches which could be self-serving in the short and long term, but which can successfully be employed.
Thank you very much for these examples, Justin. Let me, in response to the first question in particular, share one experience I've had before turning to Daniel to say a few words on all that, plus perhaps the point that I'm going to make. What has changed? It was about 25 years ago. I was working for the World Bank, and I went to a small to medium-sized African country to look at the industrial sector, development constraints, and so on. And I found there were two car assembly plants producing, and I'm not going to say the actual cars and countries and all that, but producing two types of cars, actually rather luxurious cars. But the way it was done is that basically these cars were imported in pieces from Europe and assembled. There wasn't really much value added, a little bit, but very, very little. And the price of the final product produced in the country was not less than four times the price of the world market price of these cars. Okay? So obviously this didn't make any sense. There were huge tariffs. You couldn't import any cars. So whoever wanted to buy a car in that country basically had to buy the cars that were assembled. And I can't remember the number of cars produced, but it was tiny. I don't know, 200 a year or something like that. You know, very, very small amount of it. The whole thing didn't make any sense at all. And obviously our advice was you better dismantle, stop this thing because it doesn't, you know, it actually eats up resources rather than producing anything of value. I immediately had the two ambassadors of the two European countries, it wasn't the U.S. in this case, two European countries, you know, in my hotel protesting vigorously at my activities. So you had an unholy alliance of governments and business imposing really a huge cost on the countries with partnership with the local government. Now, I could give such examples, you know, hundreds of them, okay? But I think things have changed for various reasons. One, we have a much more export-oriented development philosophy now. You know, the old philosophy that you produce something behind huge tariff barriers at whatever cost, you know, I think was never really valid, but certainly is no longer the dominant thought. So once you produce for the world market, okay, you have to be competitive. You can't produce something that costs four times as much, you know, and then compete on the world market. So I think that's one thing that's helping a lot, a much more world market-oriented development philosophy. Second, I do believe that in the old days, particularly in the Cold War, the development assistance philosophy in many countries was, you know, we'll help our allies. As long as they're our allies, you know, the rest is not that important. Keep the other guys out. Whereas now I think the official development activities of most countries are much more truly development-focused. The Cold War, you know, was such that you just support whoever supported the U.S. or France against the Soviet Union, so to speak. I think, thankfully, that this is no longer the case. And the third thing that I think has changed quite a bit is NGO involvement in all of this. I mean, NGO, civil society, you know, they are following what's happening. There's criticism of wrong development policies, and I think this much wider engagement makes these old models, I think, impossible to implement. So I do believe there has been dramatic change. Things are much better now, much more promising. There still are problems. Corruption is still around and other problems. But I would single out these three things in response to your question, kind of what has changed. Daniel?
Come on. What has changed? Of course, I can't speak to every single poor country, but I could say for the 19 countries we work with, what has changed in the last 20, 25 years is the fact that they want to get away from handouts to becoming more self-sufficient so they could increase their trade activities with partner countries within Africa or the outside world. They have set up institutions that respect the rule of law that really facilitates trade investment activities. For example, 65% of our investments are primarily related to trade investment activities. They invested a lot of their money in the infrastructure, if you will. Like, to give you an example, AGOA, which allows a lot of African countries to trade with us without paying any tariffs. Well, in the past, they've never been able to take advantage of it because they have not had the infrastructure, if you will, to transport their goods and services because they did not have the proper infrastructure, no roads or no ports that weren't sufficient to transport their goods. So they're making significant investments in those areas. They're committed to the rule of law, and they're putting institutions, if you will, that respects property rights, that protects, infringements of I'm escaping my mind right now, but the copyrights. And, again, these are countries that have changed significantly that want to replace $8 with investments, the dollar from the private sector. In terms of China, of course, you know, China has been very active in Africa. And here, if you look in terms of what we trade, it's been primarily in five countries in Africa, those countries that have mineral resources of oil. And this is a tremendous opportunity for American businesses, especially as you look in terms of the newly emerged countries that have done a great job in reforming their policies in attracting foreign capital. I think you touch basis on education. Even though our concentration in the past has been primarily to build elementary schools and high schools, I believe this is an opportunity for MCC to be able to concentrate on our higher education, to be able to produce highly educated workforce, to be able to complement the growth that's taking place in the country. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have time for maybe two or three more questions. Yes, all the way in the back. Two gentlemen and then a lady.
Okay, hi, Peter Sommer with Merger Market. One of the things about African investments is it's getting more and more clear that some of these non-government organizations and other issues are sort of overshadowing the growth in private sector companies, both those coming into Africa and those in Africa. Is there any way that we can separate the two issues? Let the private sector talk about the private sectors and let the NGOs concentrate on the loss-leading issues like HIV, prevention in Africa, things that the private sector cannot fund, and let the private sector continue growth. And the other issue is, it seems more and more clear that the companies who have, who are ready for global growth, who are leaders, have a presence in Africa, and then those who have not, who have been domestically focused in the United States and elsewhere, are now going through the hardest period of time in this moment.
All right, yes. There was one more question in the back. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Archana Palaniapin with Oxfam America. Thank you very much for your comments today. The panel highlighted several imbalances with aid and trade, and I wanted to ask, how can we ensure that our private investment aims are in alignment towards the same development goals? Would referring to a national strategy for global development be useful for guidance to make sure that aid, trade, and U.S. businesses aren't working at cross purposes and disadvantaging others in poverty further?
Right. Anybody else? Yes?
Fletcher Hall, F.R. Hall and Associates. I was wondering if I want to pick up on Mr. Solis's comments about particularly U.S. policy toward economic development and global growth. What are our attitudes? How does the business community see our attitudes, the United States attitudes, particularly in view of competition from other countries who are very active in most parts of the world and particularly in Africa?
Yes, I guess that's the last one in the back there.
Hi, my name's Jim Sosnicki. I work for SAFE here in Washington, D.C. I was at a meeting recently with a major American integrated oil company that talked about the importance of changing the language and the terms we use. We use today the term corporate social responsibility a lot, but this particular company found that their people in the field, their operations managers, took that more seriously when you called it social risk management. Everyone has an environmental risk management plan. Everyone has a security risk plan. But CSR has always been something that's been kind of passed back to the corporate foundations back at the headquarters. I'm wondering, do you see a shift, for those of you representing corporations, do you see a shift pushing this down to making this an operational matter and therefore maybe being more effective that way? Thank you.
All right. Maybe we'll start, with Justin and go across and end with Danielle very briefly. Maybe a last point you'd like to make. I sense that there still is this, one question, the first question in this round still was this thing, can we separate, so to speak, social goals and, NGO activity from business goals? And actually the message from the panel overall, I think, is that while these goals, are not necessarily identical, they actually are very complementary and a total separation is not really what we're trying to do. But there is still this this issue of profit seeking as the main motive versus broader social responsibilities, and I think it's we've had a discussion with Sonal Shah the other day right here, who heads the innovation group at the White House, and again the same point came up, and there was an issue about profit making versus profit maximizing and so on. So maybe some thoughts on this central issue might be welcome.
Okay, very quickly. I think that's. I started off with the issue of the architecture that in which the business is being done deliberately, because that issue the question goes to the heart of the architecture. You know, in most of the countries that, you know, we tend to do business in Africa, the role of the government traditionally has always been, you know, to do everything, you know, in terms of especially where the private sector will not go. Now, in that role, it will look at its complementary partners who will be most likely people that are providing foreign aid as part of the steps that are necessary for it to establish the capacity necessary. So to some extent, Chair, you answered it very aptly. We cannot, strictly speaking, see the separation of these two goals, although ideally that would help. Because my own view, in fact, which we have not really touched on fully, is, you know, whatever aid we're looking at should also have an exit mechanism as a starting point. Then whatever it cannot be exited from is really the space where the NGOs, et cetera, will continue to play a role, because that will be relief. It will be aid that will always constantly be required for you know, maybe as unforeseen, if you will.
Chad?
I think on the question you posed, there's so much you can do writing checks to a country, but I say that's 1% of the impact a company can have. It's primarily in developing economic stability, as Tim pointed out. The thing I would add to that, though, is the pot comes in with the same environmental standards in any developing country we have in the most developed country. We come in with the same ethical standards, and we'll never bend. So I think the example of showing you can live by those two standards and still make money is also a very important example that we're teaching the country. If I had to give advice to mid-sized companies, the question came up earlier about, okay, the Cummings and the DuPonts are in, but what about the next set of companies that aren't there? I think one of the biggest things that concerns them is, can I trust the government? And we had one experience in DuPont. We went into a developing country. There was I won't name the country or the technology, but there was a level of technology zero. We brought in level of technology three, much better for the country, help it develop, allow it to develop more export industries. We thought we'd be very well received. We were welcomed by the government. We built our plant. And then we found a tariff on our key raw material that had to be imported that made it so great our cash cost of producing wasn't there. We could only operate about three more months. We had to shut down. Then a local producer decided they would buy our plant for about 10 cents on the dollar. We sold it. And, you know, the next month that tariff was taken down. Okay? So, and believe me, when people come and ask us about going to that country, we tell them that story very loud. So I would say somehow don't have that kind of conduct, but also find routes that companies can get comfortable. And one of the things I mentioned, I lived in Tokyo and was developing in Asia Pacific. Little thing we would do, the countries of Asia Pacific always have a really good ambassador in Tokyo, and they weren't used to Americans showing up on their doorstep. And so I would go in, and I bypassed all the bureaucracy, and I said, give me the real truth about how you do business in that country. I learned a lot more than I did through all the other ranks. So I think countries should create a trusted route to find out what's going on and build in safeguards so companies aren't worried about what the government will do.
Thank you. Tim?
I don't think you can separate your responsibility to the community and your business goals. They're very closely integrated. We use a model called the stakeholder concept, and the idea is that you have to consider the needs of each of the stakeholders when you make a decision. So it's the employees, it's customers, it's suppliers, the communities in which you live, and so forth. And what we say is that you have to behave responsibly or make decisions responsibly for each of the stakeholders, and when there is a conflict, you have to wrestle with that. And to me, when you say the community is a stakeholder, you have to consider that in your business. And when you say, well, HIV, if you're in a country and you have HIV/AIDS and your workforce is dying, you have a responsibility to deal with that issue just in order to have the folks. In terms of the jargon or the terminology, I did not use the term corporate social responsibility. I use the term corporate responsibility because we believe the term social implies that it's voluntary, that it's something nice to do. Where if you use corporate responsibility, we say that's a mandate, that's part of your business responsibility, which goes to that same thing. In terms of U.S. policy, just briefly, the trade policies, whether free trade agreement or tax or supporting the Millennium Challenge Corporation, which is one of the best ideas the government's had in a long, long time, all of those things that make it easier for businesses to do business in different countries is going to create jobs. An example, again, in China and India, we developed a local supply base because we had to have local content. That local supply base then becomes a low-cost country source and use as a global supplier. They have Tier 2 suppliers. It's that type of thing. If we can get in countries and develop and behave responsibly the way it is, that it'll have the biggest impact in terms of reducing poverty.
Thank you very much. Daniel, you have the last word.
Thank you very much, Kamal. Again, what makes MCC programs extremely attractive is, number one, the country ownership portion of it. I mean, the projects that come to us do not come directly from the government. They come primarily after government consulted with NGOs, civil society businesses, and also we make the decision primarily based on what's the best return for a lot of our investments. So from the beginning to the end, countries have ownership to their programs. That's why we look in terms of the long-term view and in terms of how these countries may be able to replace many of these investment dollars, if you will, from the private sector, because it is transparent, it's country-owned, and these are countries that are interested in making sure that they replace the aid dollars with the private sector investments.
Well, thank you very much, really, for taking the time to be with us. Thank you all for coming this morning, and I think we had a great discussion.